This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. On Election Day, Massachusetts citizens will weigh in on a referendum known as Question 3. A yes vote preserves existing protections for trans individuals against discrimination in public spaces. A no vote returns the state to its pre-2016 status quo, in which transgender was not a legally protected class. The messaging on the no side of Question 3 has featured the sort of scare tactics you might expect in such a key battle within the American culture wars, including this attack ad produced by the No on 3 campaign.
What does Massachusetts Question 3 mean to you? It means any man who says he is a woman can enter a woman's locker room, dressing room, or bathroom at any time. Vote No on 3. This bathroom bill puts our privacy and safety at risk. It goes too far.
It's an almost comically anti-trans video, but in a remarkable exercise in political homeopathy, the activists on the other side of the question, many themselves trans, went door to door to share that ad with potential voters. It was not a random tactic. It emerged based on the work of Stanford professor David Brockman, who a few years ago in Florida, on another trans-related ballot question, began applying his research findings to supercharge the age-old political process of door-to-door canvassing by just plain talking to the person who answers the door.
Now, a lot of people have skepticism about this kind of approach because they say, well, there's no way that you could knock on a stranger's door and get them to talk to you, much less tell these kinds of stories. But what we actually found in the research is that canvassers who had just gone through a simple morning training were able to have conversations where the vast majority of voters who were home opened the door, had the conversation, and told a story from their life. So I think our fellow Americans are actually remarkably open to reflecting and thinking about their political views, about these kinds of topics, if they're approached in such a way from a friendly person who is open and wants to have that kind of conversation with them.
So once you've initiated the perspective having, what's the effect? The person becomes suddenly more open to other outgroups like trans citizens?
Just like clinical trials for medicine, where you'd randomly assign patients to a blood pressure pill or a sugar pill, we did the same thing in this study where we randomly assigned voters to either get the kind of perspective-taking intervention that I mentioned or a control group that got a door knock about recycling. What we find when we do a series of follow-up surveys, 3 days, 3 weeks, 6 weeks, and 3 months later, is that when we compare the group that we had the conversation with at the door versus the group we could have but did not, that treatment group is significantly more accepting of transgender people across a variety of items. The average effect is on the order of about 15 percentage points, if you had to put it in those terms. Another way to think about it is that if you look at the change on items that measure attitudes towards gay men and lesbians and the average attitudes in 1998 and 2012, we see a similar effect from these 10-20-minute conversations as we see in the public in general from 1998 to 2012. So that's a really, really big effect.
Does this inoculate them against political advertising that engages in hateful hot-button pressing?
One thing we actually did in one of the follow-up surveys is actually show the voters in both the treatment and control groups one of those transphobic advertisements to say, well, if we show them these ads, is the effect of the canvas going to, say, go away as everyone retreats into a transphobic corner? Although we do find the ad has some immediate effect, we still find the treatment group we canvassed is much more supportive. Moreover, several weeks later, it seems as though the effect of the ad has completely evanesced. What we find time and again is that the effects of those kinds of mass media advertisements are very ephemeral.
Now, doesn't your research fly in the face of academic orthodoxy on the matter of campaign theory?
we're actually entering this really interesting period, which is sort of like when medicine moved from putting leeches on people and telling anecdotes like, well, I put a leech on Mary and Mary got better, so you should put a leech on yourself too. We're kind of still, I would say, in the early days of using these rigorous, real-world randomized trials that revolutionized medicine. So there's different versions of orthodoxy depending on who you subscribe to, but my personal view is that we actually just know remarkably little about the real-world impacts of this kind of campaign activity. I don't think our study is going to be the last word on the matter. It's much more like one of the first words on the matter of this particular kind of intervention. But we're doing lots of follow-up work on other issues like immigration, abortion, to kind of flesh out our understanding of this.
TV campaigns reach a lot of people. And door-to-door canvassing is limited to the number of volunteers you have to fan out in a community, which is why the campaign industrial complex is built around television advertising. So let's just say the effects that you found in your studies hold true through subsequent studies and become the received wisdom of political campaigning. There's still the problem of seeing enough individual voters at their doorsteps to really have any effect.
There actually are plenty of political campaigns, the Bernie Sanders campaign in 2016, the Beto O'Rourke campaign right now in Texas, and many others who have succeeded in recruiting just a huge number of volunteers to go talk to their neighbors and knock on doors. So from my perspective, if campaigns don't try and really think about the art and science of recruiting volunteers and building a team to talk to their neighbors, then it's no surprise that if they don't make a good try at it, they're not going to have much success. And in terms of the dollars and cents of it, I think it's also a vision of American democracy that normatively we might like a little better too. You don't need a big campaign budget or to do lots of fundraisers with rich donors to be able to bankroll a serious field team. What you need is a candidate or a cause that many kinds of engaged individuals want to go volunteer their time to spread the word about.
In 2 weeks' time, we'll know how Massachusetts voted on question three. Will that tell us anything definitive about inoculation? Is there some way that we could find ourselves on sounder statistical footing on the subject of inoculation, or are we going to have to wait for still more peer-reviewed social science to materialize?
I would really resist the temptation to generalize too much from any particular election result. That's kind of the trap that the research on campaigns and elections and campaign consulting has been in for 100 years. What we really would like to know is what would have happened in the campaign if they had done something else, which of course we can't know because the campaign only happened a particular way. So that's why we need these kinds of rigorous clinical trials to randomly assign voters or districts or whatever else to say, we can actually see what happens when we do this and when we don't.
Yeah, but just between you and me, should I be like investing heavily in clipboard futures?
Well, I think what we tend to see in other industries is that as new ideas and innovations come out of academia, they diffuse over time and relatively slowly into the real world. So I don't know that I think that campaigns will or even necessarily should be taking this one study we have and, you know, reorienting all their activities around it within the next year. I hope on the scale of 10 or 20 years, we'll have built up the kind of evidence base that is very persuasive and rigorous, and that prejudice reduction advocates will be interested in applying in their work.
David, thank you so much.
Sure, thank you.
David Brockman is a political scientist at the Graduate Business School of Stanford University. Matt Collette has been reporting on the Question 3 campaign for the WNYC podcast, Nancy. Matt, welcome to OTM.
Thanks a lot, Bob.
All right, so in the late summer, you went up to Massachusetts, and you tagged along with the door-to-door campaign in support of yes on Question 3. That is to say, yes, keep these laws on the books. What did that campaign look like?
So it's this like super enthusiastic, super grassroots organization, which is a word people use a lot. But like these volunteer sessions began and ended with things that sort of doubled as training sessions and like we're all going to be okay group therapy sessions.
So here are some tips for you as you're heading out to turf. One is be tenacious, which means keep going. And if someone comes to the door, assume that they are at least interested enough to answer the door. So don't give them that space to say no or to say I'm busy. So instead of saying, do you have time, just launch into your script.
Hi. Hey, good morning. I'm looking for Beatrice or Joseph.
Yeah.
Oh, that's fine. My name's Dee. I'm with the Yes on 3 campaign, which is the campaign to protect transgender equality in Massachusetts.
After you reach a certain point in the conversation, you say, like, hey, here's this ballot question. How are you going to vote on it? Here's how it's going to affect me personally or affect people I know. They then ask,
I know that this is an issue that's been getting a lot of attention lately in, like, the press and just sort of in general. Have you heard anything in the news or on social media or just in a face-to-face conversation that's given you any hesitation or doubt about your vote?
And they're basically trying to fish for concerns. A lot of times coming with these ballot questions are concerns and fears that get raised and get propagated about sex offenders in bathrooms and men just taking advantage of these laws to pretend that they are transgender, pretend to go into women's restrooms just so they can lurk in there. Then they take out a tablet computer and say, there's actually been ads.
They made an ad just about this, and I'd love to show it to you.
Sexual predators in women's bathrooms think it can't happen.
So yeah, here's the thing that they call inoculation, which is basically exposing in a controlled dose this opposition message, which they know it's really likely that this voter could encounter, you know, on Facebook or when they're watching the news. And what they want to do is administer this opposition message in a controlled environment where the voter isn't alone, where they're not seeing a bunch of other comments on Facebook. They can encounter this with somebody there to walk them through it and help pull them back from the brink. It's a lot like getting a flu vaccine where your body gets a tiny, tiny bit of the flu virus and the white blood cells in your blood just are like, oh, okay, we know what to do in case we encounter it later.
Vote no on 3. This bathroom bill puts our privacy and safety at risk. It goes too far.
It's like, what did you think about that? Does it raise any concerns for you?
No, but in a way, not to offend the transgender people or whatever you want to call us. It would be better, I think, for both sides to have their own bathroom.
Interesting.
So, in other words, you people are going to be criticized or whatever, name calling or whatever they want to do, and the other people will just be able to keep their mouth shut.
Right. I hear what you're saying. So you're sort of saying that transgender people should have their own place to go just so they can kind of be spared from people who might have a problem with it?
Well, just the bathrooms.
Yeah.
I mean, if you're going out to eat, no, there should be no problem.
Right. Yeah.
At all. But I think in places like that, so the transgender doesn't get upset or somebody doesn't start yelling, screaming for police or whatever.
Right. That's a really interesting perspective, and I don't think I've heard it phrased quite that way before. It makes a lot of sense in a lot of ways. Something that's complicated about it, I think, is that there are a lot of transgender people who you wouldn't know were transgender walking down the street, if you know what I mean. I think it gets a little dicey where you draw the line, if you know what I mean.
Beatrice, at the start of this conversation, you know, she was confused at first about the wording of the question, but then was like, oh yeah, I'd vote yes. I support equal rights for everybody. It's sort of a thing everybody can kind of agree on. And then she suddenly introduced this idea that this could allow sex offenders and criminals to take advantage of this weak law and put her grandkids at risk. And then she suddenly starts to weigh a bunch of things. On one hand, she says, like, she used to be a nurse and she would have never turned away a transgender person. At the same time, she's like, ever since I was a little kid, I went to Catholic school and, like, there were boys' rooms and girls' rooms. And that's just, like, how the world has worked all along.
When the canvasser, Dee, left Beatrice's house, what was the net-net of the conversation?
So at the end, Dee has to ask the same question she asked at the beginning. How are you going to vote on this?
When our non-discrimination law is on the ballot, will you vote yes to keep these protections or vote no to repeal them?
Yes.
The vote yes. And would you say definitely yes or probably yes?
Yes.
Great.
Right.
Thank you.
Everybody has their own life to live, and how they want to live is their business.
Thank you so much. Yeah. I really appreciate it.
How do you feel that went?
It went well. What she was saying about having different restrooms for transgender people, like, the words, like, separate but equal crossed through my head, and that's not really necessarily the right argument to bring to her because it's, you know, we don't want to be too confrontational while we're doing this work. because we can't, you know, we can't bring somebody all the way. But she was somebody, she was a nice lady, definitely a good conversation.
Nice.
Yeah.
Where to next?
Let me take 1 second. Yeah. I'm going to call some of my...
I don't know. I left feeling a little more skeptical. Some conversations, I definitely felt certain. I was like, yep, this sort of inoculation idea has happened. But I think a lot of times it can be messy and you leave people with like a storm of ideas that maybe aren't completely resolved. And some of it, like, you're not going to resolve in a 10 or 15 minute conversation with a stranger at your door. And maybe it planted a seed. And now as Beatrice sees this in the news, sees it in the newspaper, sees a commercial like this, she'll understand the context to which it exists. But it's also possible that she'll never really think of this again.
Now, this is all an interesting bit of political science and campaign strategy speculation at the moment. But it's also something particularly of the moment. The Trump administration apparently is working on a workaround so that transgender as a category of citizen effectively will cease to be, and then therefore any particular protections rendered moot. Does that add urgency to the Question 3 campaign?
My theory going into this, and what I heard from people on the ground there, is that basically, if this loses in Massachusetts, anti-trans activists all over the country can go around and they can say, if liberal Massachusetts doesn't want these protections, why should we have them in Wyoming or West Virginia or anywhere that these come up for debate?
So, too far out of the mainstream, even for the People's Republic of Massachusetts.
Exactly. I think the other thing is that it took a long time for the gay rights movement to get to a point where they had majority support. It can be really hard to get a majority of people to vote for a minority, especially if they don't know them or if they don't understand them. The trans community is so much smaller than the gay and lesbian community. I think it can be even harder to move the needle. So if a strategy like this inoculation thing works, or at least shows us a new angle that might be able to be taken in the LGBT and queer rights movement, it's promising. I don't know that it might work as well on an issue like abortion that a lot of people have thought a lot about and made up their minds. I think that's where the research wants to see where you can continue this. But right now, I think it works on something that people haven't actually given a lot of thought to in the first place.
Matt, thank you very much.
Thanks so much, Bob.
Matt Collette is the senior producer of Nancy, a podcast about all things LGBTQ, made right here in our producing station, WNYC. That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Alana Casanova-Burgess, Michael Loewinger, Leia Fetter, and John Hanrahan. We had more help from Asta Chaturvedi and Samantha Maldonado, and our show was edited this week by our executive producer, Katya Rogers. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineers this week were Sam Baer and Josh Hahn. Jim Schachter is WNYC's vice president for news. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is a production of WNYC Studios. I'm Bob Garfield.
On the Media is supported by the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio.